We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Do we want a constitution here in the United States that changes over time to adapt to changing circumstances, or should the U.S. Constitution be a rock-solid foundation, something that embodies in an unchanging and constant way our most fundamental principles? Is there some way, in fact, that we could have both? Well, our guest for this hour of Focus, David Strauss, who's professor of law at the University of Chicago, says that actually, mostly, we have managed to do just that, have it both ways, because we have a system of law that depends as much on precedent and past practices as it does on the written Constitution itself. This morning, in this hour of the program, we'll look at this great debate over how one should read the Constitution and what its basic nature should be, and that is the subject of a book that David Strauss has authored. The title is The Living Constitution, and it is published by the Oxford University Press. It's out now, so certainly you can seek it out if you'd like to read what he has to say. And of course, here on the program, your comments and questions are welcome too. Now, we just ask people to be brief. That way we can get in as many callers as possible, but certainly people can call and they may email. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, our toll-free number. That's 800-222-9455. And you may email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. A little bit more about our guest, David Strauss. He is the Gerald Ratner Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. He is a leading constitutional law scholar. He's an editor of the Supreme Court Review and also served as special counsel to the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee and Assistant Solicitor General of the United States. And Professor Strauss, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. To introduce the topic just a little further for those people, and I include myself, who are not constitutional scholars, just to make sure that they understand what the two poles of the debate are. We should talk a little bit about originalism on the one hand and textualism on the other. Those are the technical terms we're talking about. Let's start with originalism, just basically what it is. What is originalism?
Well, originalism is really one pole of this debate that you referred to, David. And it's the pole that says when we're trying to apply the Constitution today to some issue that we have in the courts or in society today, that what we should do is to try to go back and look at what the people who drafted the Constitution, or maybe it's the people who ratified the Constitution, but in any event, that founding generation, we should go back and look at what they thought about freedom of speech, say, or freedom of religion, and try to take their understandings or their intentions and apply them today.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that's sort of the one extreme end of the continuum. Then on the other end is something called textualism. And so what's that?
Well, textualism actually is pretty much at the same end as originalism, although it emphasizes more the specific words. Huh. The other end of the spectrum, it's hard to define, and that's part of the problem, but at least the way it's caricatured by a lot of people is judges should just keep the Constitution up to date by doing what they think is right. So we're sort of faced with the choice between either a Constitution that's been frozen in time or a Constitution that can be updated by the judges as they see fit.
All right. So obviously right out of the box there, I'm confused by the terminology myself. So essentially, though, what we're talking about here is on the one hand, the idea that one should be able to, or at least should try, to see the world as the people who wrote this document saw it, and to try to think that way. That's the one side. The other side is something that says, kind of argues, well, it's not the same world. And in fact, that what they had in mind was something that had the flexibility so that it would be able to change because they would have to have known, to anticipated the fact that the country would change, the world would change, and you had to have some kind of document that would change with it.
No, that's right, and you're right that the words, the terminology really gets in the way, and tends to get thrown around in a kind of unenlightening fashion. But that's right. That's the essential dilemma, that on the one hand, to say the Constitution is frozen in time and what we should just try to do is to do what they would have done in the 18th century, on the one hand, that seems implausible, and my view is that is, in fact, really totally implausible. But the other side seems to be, well, just, you know, whoever is running the show at a particular time, whoever happens to have the power, gets to update the Constitution as they see fit, and that also seems unsatisfactory.
Well, that seems there are both one can see a reason to sympathize with both of these points of view. You can also identify, and we may talk some more about it, particular problems with these points of view. So, but you're making a different kind of argument here, and that is, well, anybody that would tell you that we actually have to make a choice between those two, you're saying, well, that's actually a false choice, because if you look at actually what we do as a practical matter and what we have done is that we've actually managed to steer a course kind of between the two.
Exactly. And we've almost done it without realizing that we've done it. I think if you look at the way the law is developed, for the most part, not in every single respect, but for the most part, the way it's developed, it hasn't fallen prey to either of those two really unsatisfactory horns of the dilemma.
Mm-hmm. And this is really interesting, because it does indeed seem to be a fairly intense debate, at least among legal scholars. It's an intense debate, people have strongly held opinions, and some of them are Supreme Court justices, and some of them are important law professors, and they would make it seem as if there isn't any middle ground to occupy, but you're actually saying, well, no, that's really not true.
That's right, and you're right, it is a strong debate, and particularly, you know, in the academy, of course, where all kinds of things are strong debates, but also among judges and even a little bit among politicians and other people in society. And I think part of the problem is that when the debate gets cast in these very stark terms, that either we go back to what James Madison and the boys wanted to do, or, on the other hand, it's all up for grabs. When you cast in those stark terms, you sort of lose track of what's really going on, and you're in a position where people are claiming, for example, just to be channeling what the framers wanted to do, but that's not what they're really doing, because that really doesn't work. And then people begin kind of hiding the ball a little bit, and I think that's really not the way we should go.
Well, I suppose that does invite the question that what in whose debate is it to continue to fan the flames on this?
Well, I think the sort of rhetorical, there's a powerful rhetorical advantage when you're arguing about the Constitution to say, you know, listen, this isn't my idea. This is the idea of the founding fathers. And, you know, if you don't agree, you're not disagreeing with me. You're disagreeing with them. I mean, that's a powerful rhetorical position to be in. And I think that's one reason that view, the view that's called originalism, although as we said, the terminology doesn't matter, but the view that we ought to go back to first principles, that's one reason it's stuck around. It really does give you a huge advantage in a debate to be able to claim, incorrectly in my view, that all you're really doing is carrying out someone else's, you know, the founding fathers' intentions.
Mm-hmm. Some people might look at it this way, and talking about originalism, they might say, well, yes, it's true. There's many, many ways, so many ways we can point to American life, early American life and present American life, and say that there are so many things that we have here that simply didn't exist, issues that didn't exist. The country that we have now didn't exist. So that's the case. And yet, when you look at the Constitution and you look at the sorts of issues that it deals with, can one make the argument, you have any sympathy with the argument that says, but they're actually so basic and so fundamental that somehow they transcend the fact that now we have interstate commerce and we have the internet and we have assault weapons and, you know, whatever example that you want to cite for the ways in which American life today is different than it was then?
I think that's an important point. It depends on what you're looking in the Constitution for. If you're looking in the Constitution for basic principles sort of general principles that are to guide us today. You know, I think that's fine. I think that's something everyone can agree on, that the basic principles at the core of the Constitution are great ones. But basic principles don't solve concrete problems. And if you have a highly specific issue, you know, is this particular gun control law constitutional? Does this particular law exceed Congress's power? If you have a specific issue like that, the general principles really don't solve it for you. So then you have to look at something else. And I think where the kind of slippage comes in is people moving from the position that the general principles embodied in the Constitution should govern us today, which I think is something everyone can agree with, moving from that to saying, well, here we have a particular law that Congress passed on health care or whatever, and I'm going to see what did the framers think about that. Mm-hmm. And that's the step that I think just becomes untenable.
And I think that also that you would go as far as to argue that, in fact, if you take the most literal reading of that document, that it says things, it says particularly things about rights and freedoms and who has them and who doesn't, that today we simply do not accept.
One of the surprising things about American history is that if you look back at some of the specific attitudes that our founders had or that were held at the time of the Civil War, for example, when the Constitution was changed in important ways, if you look at their specific attitudes, a lot of the things they thought are really, as you say, David, totally unacceptable to us today. I mean, they thought people could be punished for blasphemy. A lot of them thought, this is inconclusive on this point, but a lot of them thought you could actually be put in jail for criticizing the government. And today we would think, I mean, that's totally unthinkable. At the time of the Civil War, for example, when the great amendments embracing a principle of equality were adopted, the idea that you couldn't discriminate against women was far out. It was a fringe idea. And today, of course, it's completely mainstream. Yeah. But one of the great things that the drafters of the Constitution did for us is they didn't write their specific ideas into the Constitution. They drafted it, for the most part, in very general terms. And that gives us the responsibility and the obligation to take those general principles and to fill them out today.
Mm. Maybe one other question, and I have somebody here who's holding, and I'm going to get to you, and I promise I won't make them wait forever. Just to turn to the other side just for a moment, those people who argue for originalism, one of the things that concerns them is unchecked judicial power, and that is they say if you don't take that strict interpretation, you know, the Constitution means what it means and the words are what they are, that gives far too much latitude to individual judges to bring their own interpretation to their own concerns, their own agenda. What is there, if you would say, well, it's actually not like that, what would you say, where are the checks on judicial power?
Well, that's the critical question, absolutely. And here's what I'd say to a person who makes that argument, which is an important argument. The checks on judicial power come from actually where they have come from for centuries, even going back before the Revolution to English law. They come, in my view, from precedent and tradition. And judges, by instinct and by training, follow precedent. And precedent guides them, precedent limits them. And we have actually centuries of experience outside of constitutional law and much less kind of high-profile but very important areas of law, like those dealing with property and contracts, centuries of experience of judges being guided and limited, not 100% limited, but very substantially limited by precedent. And what I'd say is, on the other hand, if you say to judges, as some people who believe in this idea of originalism and following the founders, some people say, look, forget the precedents, just look at what the founders said. The truth is that often what the founders said is so unclear and applies so indirectly to today's circumstances that if you tell judges that, that's what takes the limits off. Because, boy, you give me the history or the text, the document, there are all kinds of things I can do. But you say to me, no, you've got to follow 200 years of accumulated precedent. That's what really hedges me in if I'm a judge.
Yeah. Well, and at the same time, though, there are certainly notable examples where precedent has been tossed aside. And maybe the biggest example that you can point to is civil rights, where at some point the court simply said, you know what we've been doing for all this time? It's not right.
That's right. There are famous examples of that, and the one you mentioned, David, is the most famous, where the Supreme Court said the rule had been separate but equal. You can segregate the races as long as you maintain equality. And the Supreme Court came along and said, you know what, separate really can't be equal, and segregation has to end. But if you look at that particular decision, a couple of things jump out at you. One is this idea that segregation is no good. That's not what the people who drafted the constitutional provision in question, that's not what they thought. They were actually pretty comfortable with racial segregation. And the other thing is, so you can't say, well, we're adopting that principle because the founders wanted it. In fact, the Supreme Court was very careful not to say that when it decided that case. The other thing you can see, and this kind of, to my mind, vindicates the idea that we have a system built on precedent. When the Supreme Court reached that decision in 1954, it could actually look back on five decades and say, you know, for these five decades, supposedly the principle we've been working with was separate but equal is okay. You can have segregation if you maintain equality. But if you look at our decisions, we have never once for 50 years found a system of segregation that actually was equal. We kept saying, and this is an accurate description of the law, we kept saying, well, yeah, you've segregated this school, but you didn't maintain equality. And you've segregated this school. If you'd only maintained equality, that would be okay, but you didn't maintain equality. And really what the Supreme Court was saying in 1954 was, you know, the lesson of experience is separate can never be equal.
Our guest in this hour of focus, David Strauss. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a leading constitutional law scholar and is the author of a recently published book, The Living Constitution. It is published by the Oxford University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers here. We'll start with Champagne and line one. Hello.
I called for one thing, which I want to get to, dealing with international law and the issues with that, but I want to make two quick comments about what you said just now. First is this business of separate but equal. That was something that was created by the courts in the end of the 19th century. So in a sense, we did have the change, and the change was in the Civil War and the amendments that follow it. And similarly, the issue with the attitude towards women came about because there was a change. I mean, it was just the amendment that gave women the right to vote, but that was indicative of a larger change in the society and in the Constitution, therefore. But my issue is more with the problem with international or so-called international law or the law of other nations. There's an issue that just was in the news today where Great Britain is having a problem because it had its own law, had one ruling having to do with some terrorists, and then the European Court and of Human Rights and the European bureaucracy and rules have come out with a different ruling, or at least a different ruling was applied, and now all of a sudden they're stuck. I think this issue of the use of international law, or let me say it differently, laws of other nations and of supranation bureaucracies such as the UN and European courts and so on, where they're applying their own ideas, which are in some ways inimical to the basic ideas of the United States Constitution, and then there are judges in the United States who attempt to use that to change the laws in the United States. I think that's a major issue, and obviously the Supreme Court has already had to deal with that in different ways. So I'd like to, those are my comments, and I'd like to hear what you have to say, and I'll listen on the air. Thank
you. Yeah. Professor Strauss?
Well, thanks. On the question of foreign law, law of other countries, I think there are two issues that should be separated. There are some ways in which we have taken international law, particularly as it's reflected in treaties, and we have deliberately, through our governmental processes, made that part of our law. In some cases, it can even be enforced in court. And when we've done that, I think everyone would agree, in fact, it actually says it right in the Constitution, that treaties are the supreme law of the land, and we have to follow that. But that's when we have incorporated it deliberately into our law. The other question, I think the question the caller was really referring to, is a little more complicated, and that's the question of, you know, we look around the world, we see other countries do things in different ways. Should that have any influence at all on what we do? And I think the answer to that is something you can't really give in absolute terms. I mean, obviously, we are not under any obligation to follow the law of other countries. Our court should follow the law of this country. So I think the attitude that our judges should take, and I think really the attitude they do take to other countries is, you know, let's take a look at what they're doing. Maybe we can learn from something from it. Maybe we're going to take a look at it and say, boy, that really doesn't work. Let's not go down that road. Maybe we'll take a look at it and say, you know, that's an idea worth considering. Let's try it out in a form modified to take account of the differences in our culture. But really that kind of looking at it as a source of enlightenment rather than looking at it as a potential source of enlightenment. Sometimes it won't be enlightening at all. Looking at it that way rather than looking at it as binding law, I think that's really the only plausible way for our judges to go. And I actually think our judges, that's all they in fact do.
All right. I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Let's go for another comment here. Bloomington, Indiana, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I think our founders, in a strict constructionist way, gave us a method to bring the Constitution up to date, to make it live. It's called amendment. And they gave us several methods of amending the Constitution. It's very clear that the Supreme Court distorts our Constitution when it does not make it live. It does not bring it up to date. For example, in 1972, when the Supreme Court was considering Roe versus Wade, they were going to make abortion a constitutional right. There was a ballot issue in the liberal state of Michigan as to whether those Michiganders, those liberals in Michigan, wanted to legalize abortion. And I don't know the exact. I know it was the issue failed. By over 70%, if memory serves, when it was a large majority of the people in the liberal state of Michigan did not want abortion to be legal, and yet the Supreme Court made it legal anyway. That's not bringing the Constitution up to date. That's distorting it. And you yourself mentioned that there were laws against blasphemy, which is an open admission that the separation of church and state did not exist. It's a bogus issue. The late Chief Justice Rehnquist examined that issue of separation in church and state and finds it nowhere in history. It's a distortion of the Constitution. You're not talking about a free Constitution. You're talking about a distorted Constitution.
Well, Professor Strauss, you want to respond to that?
Well, the question about the amendment process is certainly a fair question. The question would be, as the caller put it, look, why don't we just use the process provided for in the Constitution for amendments? There is an article of the Constitution that tells us, here's how you amend this document. If we're concerned about updating it, why don't we just use that? Totally fair question. Here is the thing about the amendment process. It turns out to be extremely difficult to amend the Constitution. Roughly speaking, you need two-thirds of each, or one, the most common method, the method that was used for all but one amendment, you need two-thirds of each House of Congress plus three-quarters of the states, and that's a very high hurdle to overcome. The way our system has evolved, we just don't use the amendment process. That's just what our system is today. And you might say, boy, that's not what the framers envisioned. Boy, that's not such a good system. I mean, those are all arguable points. But if you're just looking at the way our Constitution works today, we do not change it through the amendment process. In fact, this is a sort of longer conversation, but I think, in fact, the amendments since the original Bill of Rights and a couple of amendments shortly after that, the amendments really haven't done that much. The society has changed kind of irrespective of the amendments. Sometimes the amendments caught up with things that already happened. Sometimes they had no effect. Society caught up with it. But that's just not the way we change things. And as I said, that's not the best system in the world, but our system is things change in a more evolutionary way through the combined work of the courts and the political branches of government just because the amendment process is so difficult. Now, as for the specific examples that the caller gave, I mean, Roe against Wade, I say this in the book, I think Roe against Wade is a difficult case. There's a lot of controversy about that case, whether the Supreme Court did the right thing, whether it went too far. And my own view is if you have a theory about the Constitution, your theory should tell you that Roe against Wade is a tough case. And if it tells you it's an easy case, then my view is your theory is not what it should be. And it's a more complicated and involved subject, but I wouldn't want to suggest just because I think it is acceptable for our constitutional law to evolve and change that every single change the Supreme Court has implemented over the years is a correct one. I think, you know, we can have an argument about whether decisions, particular decisions, are correct. We can certainly have that argument about Roe against Wade. As for separation of church and state, I mean, that's another interesting story. At the time the Constitution was adopted, a number of states, many states, actually had official state-sponsored churches, established churches of the kind that exist in lots of countries around the world. Over time, within about 20 or 30 years, they had all abolished their established churches. And by the middle of the 19th century, and certainly today, the idea that a state could say, well, you know what, here is a religion, we're going to have this religion, it is going to be the official religion of the state of Illinois, I think most people would think that you can't do that. That's clearly unconstitutional. I think that's an example of how we've evolved and our views about the quote-unquote separation of church and state, and the caller is right, there's a historical controversy about exactly what the founders thought about that principle. Our views about that have evolved from the point where state-supported, taxpayer-supported churches were considered acceptable in the states to a position today where they would be considered totally unacceptable.
I have another caller, and I will get to them in a moment. We're already at our midpoint here. I want to ask you, though, to address some of the reaction from people to your book and to the argument that you're making, because I think that there are some people who have looked at what you're saying and said that in fact that we have changed over time, and that the ways that we have changed have really been shaped by common law, by tradition, by precedent. That's really what's at work here, and then some people have looked at that and looked at your book and said, well, this guy David Strauss is saying we can just toss the Constitution away. We don't need it anymore. It doesn't matter. Now, I suspect that's really not what it is that you have in mind, but how do you respond to that?
No, that's certainly not what I have in mind. You're right. That's a possible kind of caricature of the book, and I sort of understand why people would want to caricature it that way, but it's quite incorrect. I think the Constitution the Constitution itself is in the text of the Constitution. It's an absolutely central, critical part of our law, and it's critical for a couple of reasons. One is the one we talked about, you and I, David, talked about a minute ago, that it embodies certain principles, and the principles still govern us. Today, we do have to figure out how to put flesh and bones on the principles. We can't just rely on the principles alone, and that's where precedent and tradition come into play, but the principles remain important. The other thing the Constitution does, and it's easy to overlook this because it does it so well, there are issues, you know, that the Constitution absolutely 100% resolves. You know, we're used to reading in the paper about the difficult issues, abortion and affirmative action and capital punishment and the treatment of terrorism suspects and things like that, that are really difficult issues that are controversial and end up getting litigated in court. But there are many issues that are not controversial. The Constitution settles them, and it's a very good thing that the Constitution settles them. It would be very troublesome if it did not. For example, you need to know when the president has to leave office. And he leaves office at noon on January 20th in the year after election year, period, the end. The Constitution tells us that. Everyone accepts it, and we don't have to argue about it. You know, just think how much of a mess it would be if the Constitution said something like the president should leave office after a reasonable term of years, or when the national and international climate make a transition sensible, or something like that. That would be terribly controversial. It would be a mess. And there are issues like that that the Constitution just kind of tells us, here's the way we're doing things, it's written down, no arguments, And those can be, you know, in many ways more important to the health of a society than the issues that we're all used to arguing about. But because it's something the Constitution does so well, we tend to lose sight of that. And an important point I want to make in the book is that the Constitution does that, and does that extremely well, and we have to be careful to recognize that and safeguard that function of the Constitution.
All right, let's talk with another caller in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Yeah, in a short riposte like this, it's hard to not be caricatured in some ways, but this original intentism, recently there was a person talking about the Second Amendment and saying, and he actually brought up Shay's Rebellion, which is what I always bring up, which is that if you want to look at the original intent of the constitutionalists who were worried about uprisings and people questioning the landed gentry, questioning the government because they didn't get their back pay for serving in the revolution, for amazingly enough, was one of the things that they were agitated about. Mm-hmm. People who were drafting the Constitution were very concerned about all these things, and the last thing they wanted was everybody to have a gun. They wanted a well-regulated militia. And he actually said that there was a period in history where if you didn't swear an oath to the Constitution, you could have your guns taken away from you. So that was the apparently the practice, if not the letter of the law. I don't know. But what I see happening is that, this as an example. The 14th Amendment was written after the Civil War to give rights to disenfranchised slaves, mainly. My understanding from a reliable source is that 14th Amendment cases are mainly about legal fictions like corporations. And taking a case from the Supreme Court that gives them personhood, and then applying what was intended for enfranchising real human beings who had been disenfranchised and brutalized for many years, and giving that power to corporations. It's like astonishing. It doesn't give you a simple way of looking at this whole issue, and I think the people that want a simple issue are the people that will try to manipulate the law in the service of this kind of power, and try to cut off the more complicated arguments about, you know, where the revolution went after, you know, 1776, and what was the justice of the Shays rebels, and all those things that just get dismissed as revisionist history, and even get adjudicated in Texas at the school board level to rewrite history in another way, I think. So rather inchoate, but I'd like for you to respond a bit of that, if you could.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, on the question of the 14th Amendment and corporations, you're right. The caller's right. We went through this very dark period in our history, sort of beginning in the late 19th century, extending through the first few decades of the 20th century, where the 14th Amendment, which was, as the caller said, was adopted after the Civil War, and it was adopted to protect the rights, principally to protect the rights of newly freed African Americans in the South. The 14th Amendment was not used at all to protect them. That was those decades from the late 19th to early 20th centuries were some of the darkest days in the history of American race relations. The 14th Amendment, the Constitution as a whole, were not used at all to protect African Americans, but was used very vigorously to protect the rights of corporations and individuals, too, to engage in economic transactions, really a kind of a very striking question, more than questionable. I mean, now universally repudiated, really, use of the Constitution. And the 14th Amendment is still used to protect the rights of corporations, but not in nearly so far-reaching a way. On the question of, you know, the sort of Shays' Rebellion and the right to keep and bear arms and the uses of history in this way, I think what the caller is suggesting is right and is an important insight, that when people look back in history and say, well, you know, I'm not in figuring out what to do about guns today or figuring out what to do about freedom of religion today, I'm going to see what they thought back then. The temptation to look back at what they were thinking back then and to see what you want to see, that's an overwhelming temptation. And it's an overwhelming temptation for judges, too, because the history back then is going to be murky and it's going to be very foreign. That world was so different from our world that to look at it and try to derive lessons from that world for our world, I think, is really just an invitation to do what you want to do. And you know, in good faith, I mean, you will see what you want to see in the history. And that's why I think if you're really looking for, to get back to a question you asked earlier, David, if people are really looking for ways to limit judges, you don't want to tell them, figure out what they thought when they adopted the Constitution. Mm-hmm. You want to tell them, be a judge. Look at the precedents. Look at the cases. You know, you're hedged in by those unless you have a good reason to overrule them. And that's the way you get restrained judges and at the same time a constitution that is able to adapt to changing circumstances. Mm.
Well, I think this is really an interesting and maybe difficult point, because you're arguing that we should expect judges to exercise judgment, and that's why we call them judges, and yet at the same time we have to put some limits on their exercising of that judgment. And should it simply be the case that we should say to judges, well, you feel free to exercise your judgment, but you have to justify that. Tell us exactly what your thinking is. And then I suppose, I don't know who's then has the ultimate responsibility of reviewing that. I suppose there's always going to be somebody over that person, I guess, until you get to the Supreme Court, to look at what that person's thinking was.
That's right. You have someone over you until you get to the Supreme Court. But I think the important point there is just that requiring candor itself can be an important check on what judges or really anybody else does. And if you put people in a position where you say to them, you know, listen, your authority is limited. You can't just do whatever you want. But you do have some room to maneuver. You know, when the precedents aren't clear, when they leave open a couple of courses of action, you can choose between them, and you can choose between them based on what you think is the fairer or more sensible way to do it. But then you have to justify that choice. Mm-hmm. And you have to be upfront and open and say, okay, here's why we're doing it. We're doing it because we think this makes more sense. But that in itself is an important limit on people, because they have to come forward with their reasons and expose their reasons to public view and reveal the fact that they are making a choice, that they're not just carrying forward the intentions of someone else. And I think one of the real risks of trying to go back to what did they think at the founding and what does the text of the Constitution say, one of the real risks of that is that people acting in complete good faith will not be candid about what they're doing. They will really think they are just doing what James Madison wanted, where in fact what's going on is they're doing something because they think it's a good idea. And that might be the right thing to do, but then they should be clear about it and be candid about it and allow themselves to be criticized on that basis.
Our guest is David Strauss. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's author of the book, The Living Constitutions, published by the Oxford University Press. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next caller is in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I wanted to bring up the topic, and I think it's constitutionally mandated, and that's the aspect of the Electoral College. And what I mean by that is, with the Electoral College, we're forced into a two-party system. And today, in this modern society we have, a two-party system is only black and white and produces a Congress that doesn't get anything done. A third party might enter shades of gray. Could you expound on that?
Yes, there are assets. The caller is right. There are important aspects of our system that favor a two-party system. The Electoral College is one of them, although the Electoral College does provide room for regionally based third parties. They have had, for better and worse, some success under the Electoral College. But the structure of elections we have, where it's a plurality system, whoever gets the most votes wins, even if it's less than a majority, that does favor a two-party system. The Electoral College is actually an interesting example of the way our system has changed and hasn't changed. The original idea, and this is really quite clear, the original idea was that the voters would vote for electors, and the electors would exercise independent judgment in deciding who was to be president. The idea was not at all that electors would say, you know, I am pledged to Barack Obama or I am pledged to John McCain. That wasn't the original idea at all. The original idea was I am a trustworthy citizen, a notable member of the community. You can trust my judgment, vote for me, and I will decide who should be president. That's actually quite clear. Beginning pretty early on in our history, states began enacting laws that actually required their electors to vote for certain, for the people they were pledged to vote for, so that you knew if you cast the vote for, if you pulled a lever that said Barack Obama, that while you were nominally voting for electors, your electors would were pledged to vote for Obama. The Supreme Court said that was fine, even though it was very clearly at variance with what the framers of the Constitution envisioned. This was as clear an example as you can find of a departure from the original understandings. The Constitution was not amended. We just changed things because the old system of electing local aristocrats and trusting their judgment, that just seemed obsolete in an increasingly democratic era. So that part has changed. On the other hand, the idea that we'll have an electoral college with winner-take-all voting within states rather than a popular majority, that hasn't changed, because if you look at the text of the Constitution, there's just no way around that, and we are stuck with that until the Constitution is amended. So it's, I think, an interesting example of how where the Constitution allowed us room to adapt to a more democratic world. We have done that, and most people would say that's a good thing. But it has, in some ways, limited our ability to adapt because, you know, the text is there, and there are some things you just can't interpret your way around.
We have just about five, six, 7 minutes. And I hope this question isn't so out of left field that it doesn't apply. But I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about here we're talking about what the intent of the founders was. If you can say something about what the intent of the founders was about, particularly about the Supreme Court. And I think that if you look at the Constitution and you look at the Article 3 that sets up the judicial branch, it's the part that mentions the Supreme Court is really short.
Right.
It says the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. Judges, both of the Supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior and shall at stated times receive for their services a compensation, which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really because particularly one man in particular in the early history of the court was the one who really grabbed this power for the court, the power of reviewing laws and to pass them as being either constitutional or not. That doesn't say anything about that in the Constitution. I guess I'm curious about what it was that the founders thought the Supreme Court was supposed to do.
Well, there actually is a lot of historical controversy about that. And, you know, it's one of those issues on which if you talk to five historians, you'll get six different opinions. You're right that the Constitution does not say, you will not find a provision in the Constitution that says the Supreme Court shall have the power to declare acts of Congress unconstitutional. That provision doesn't exist. Now, there is an argument that if you look at what the Constitution does say about the judicial power being vested in the Supreme Court and inferior courts that Congress establishes, and the Supremacy Clause, which says that the Constitution and laws made pursuant to it shall be the supreme law of the land, some people have said, well, you know, put those two things together, and what it tells you is someone's got to decide whether a law is pursuant to the Constitution or contradictory to the Constitution, and they will add that was a traditional understood judicial prerogative. That's the argument, that there were enough instances in history of courts doing what John Marshall said our Supreme Court could do to give historical validation to his decisions. Now, that's one view, and there are people who disagree with that view, and I think that's a sort of ongoing controversy among historians. This is an example, again, of something that's really been settled by history. However much controversy there was at the time that the Supreme Court arrogated this power or asserted this power, however much controversy there was at the time, however much controversy there might be historically over what is the proper understanding of what they were doing when they set up the courts, you know, by now it's settled. This is something the Supreme Court's been doing. It's been doing it pretty vigorously. It's done it through through good times and bad times. It's done it and been repudiated. It's done it and been celebrated. And by now, the idea that this is a proper function of the Supreme Court has just been thoroughly settled by history, not by looking back at what the framers intended, but by looking at our 200 years of constitutional growth and development. And I think it's actually an excellent example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. You won't find it in the text. You don't find it clearly in the history. The Constitution was never amended. But anybody who said now for the Supreme Court to declare acts of Congress unconstitutional, that is a usurpation, and they should stop it immediately. Anyone who said that now in such an unqualified fashion would be viewed as someone who really didn't understand how our Constitution works. Hmm.
It seems that this whole, for I expect for probably a lot of people, they may have a hard time relating to this whole conversation, and that people really only get involved in this question of reading the Constitution, I think, when a court does something they don't like. That's why when people start tossing around terms like judicial activism, that's a term that you use for a judge who does something that you didn't approve of.
Exactly.
And now, so having said that, I wonder, is it possible to say in an easy, sort of straightforward way, why it is that anybody should care about this conversation and about how it is one resolves this question?
I think people should care because it should steer them away from two kinds of ways of thinking that people might have about the Constitution and that, frankly, some judges and some people in the Academy encourage, neither of which is right. One way of thinking about it is judges ought to be, and the best judges are, simply computers. They simply go and they look at the law and they churn out a conclusion. And a judge who does anything more than that, who allows his or her own views about what's fair or what's right, a judge who does anything more than that is acting wrongly and is doing something judges should not do, is acting lawlessly. I think that's one view that is really not correct. On the other hand, the other view that judges are routinely just doing what they want is, if anything, even more incorrect. And what people should realize is that for most judges, conscientious judges, and you know, really nearly every judge that exists, however much one might disagree with their specific decisions, their freedom is not unbounded. They are limited in various ways. They can't do whatever they want. There are lots of choices that are simply off the table for them. Their room to maneuver is actually quite limited, but they do have some room to maneuver. They're not computers. They're not operating on the basis of some kind of mathematical-like algorithm that produces outcomes automatically from the facts and law that are put into the case. And that we're really dealing with a range of choice, yes, but a pretty narrow range of choice. And I think if people if we in the Academy, a lot of us and a lot of judges, you know, didn't talk the way we did, I think people might have a fuller appreciation of the reality of our process, which is not as bad as one might think in either direction.
We just have about a minute or two left. I have an email and a caller. We'll try to get them both. We'll go to the caller in Avon, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Have a question, but I can't find my source data for it. In that, about 3 weeks ago, there was an oral hearing there in the Supreme Court based on the argument of a gentleman was charged for breaking a law based on he spoke what he thought. What effect did the Constitution, you know, ever raise on judging people by what they thought?
I don't know. Is there enough detail there so that you know the case that the caller is referring to?
I don't know the case. I mean, I could say generally that one thing we've developed, again, it's something that's developed over time. It didn't spring full-blown from the decisions made in 1787 or 1789. One of the things we've developed over time is a very robust notion of free speech in which the government cannot target people for their certainly not for their thoughts, and within certain limits, not for their speech either. So So I'd have to know more about the specifics of the case to be able to say what exactly was going on there. But that principle is really a very clear one.
Yeah. Well, let me just quickly also try to get to the email in here. Someone was listening to this earlier conversation with a caller who called in and said, well, essentially, doesn't the amendment process, that's the way that we should change the Constitution. The caller poses this question, would important social changes that we have seen, for example, having to do with voting rights, with civil rights, would that have happened if we had to rely on constitutional amendments to do that?
I think the answer is very clearly not. Constitutional amendments require such an overwhelming majority of society, and not just a majority, but a majority that's sort of regionally dispersed. Three-quarters of the states have to agree, which means that if you're doing something that a particular region of the country doesn't like, you can't do it, a question that's particularly relevant, of course, to civil rights. If we had to rely on the amendment process, a lot of these changes, and many of the changes we are proudest of in our constitutional history, would not have occurred. In fact, what you often see with amendments is the amendments catch up with things that society has already agreed on that we change in some other way. You know, we adopt a vigorous federal government capable of managing the economy, or we reaffirm our commitment to equal rights, and then the Constitution comes along later, usually with some relatively minor provision to ratify what we've already done. But the amendment process, as the framers gave it to us, is just too difficult to rely on it as the means of change. At least that's been the lesson of our experience over the last 200-plus years.
And there we must stop. We're at the end of this first hour. Our guest, David Strauss, is professor of law at University of Chicago. His book is The Living Constitution. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And Professor Strauss, thanks very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We're midway through this morning's Focus. In the next hour, Celeste Quinn will be here to host the program, talking with the author of the book Breaking Bread, Recipes and Stories from Immigrant Kitchens.